This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 6:05 in the evening with Lynn and Ayman, and we're starting this hour by looking at the sharing economy here in Malaysia. Of course, recently we have seen some major headlines relating to some companies in the industry like Grab and Foodpanda. Among the issues that have arisen involve workers' rights and welfare, monopolies, government intervention, and just other things.
So today we've brought in an expert to talk all about the sharing economy, and I know you guys have a lot of thoughts and questions about this subject, so you can join in the conversation. Can call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018 789 8899, or you can also tweet us at BFM Radio.
In the meantime, joining us in the studio is April Rennie, International Advisor and Founder of the Sharing Economy Working Group at the World Economic Forum. April, hello. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So I didn't necessarily want to go into the long, varied list of the many things that you've done, but looking at it, you've worked in industries ranging from what we're here to talk about today, the sharing economy. You also have worked in terms of thinking about tourism and cities. It's a lot. Can you perhaps talk to us a little bit about your career and how you found yourself doing all these different things?
Sure. Thank you for the lovely question. It's not necessarily a short answer, but I'll try to keep this brief. I've always been fascinated and committed to how do we build business that works better and for more people. So that led me years ago to do a dual degree in law and finance, focusing on economic development. I spent many years focused on issues related to microfinance and financial inclusion in a range of frontier markets. That led me to get really interested about, the business models themselves and how they're playing out vis-a-vis other macro trends like urbanization. And then, of course, I'm based in the U.S. with one foot in San Francisco and the other foot around the world. And technology plays a big role in where a lot of this is heading. So I couldn't help but integrate the different backgrounds and perspectives. And, I've always been a junkie for travel and cultural diversity and so forth. And so really integrating those with a global perspective.
And can you tell us more about the work that you do with the Sharing Economy Working Group at the World Economic Forum?
Sure. So that was founded some time ago, very much in the nascent early days of the sharing economy, where I would walk around and talk to people, business leaders, policymakers, and I would say, do you know what the sharing economy is? And 90% of people would look at me like I was crazy. Mm-hmm. They'd never heard the term before. And the other 10% would be like, oh, yeah, isn't that some hippie thing? So this is only a few years ago, and there was a real realization that this was going to have a profound impact on business, on policy, on society, and not, lots of upsides, but a lot of blind spots too. And so there was a need to create both a place to convene and a place to share ideas, but also a place to do some early research and start raising awareness. And that was the original impetus. Now it's grown beyond that and has led to many other things as well. But also the term sharing economy here in 2019, it's no longer a term that when I ask people what it is, that they look at me blindly.
People know now.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about that term then, sharing economy, because I think it implies almost that there is a standardization of thinking about it, when in fact what we're seeing, of course, are different regulations, different companies operating within the space with a few shared principles, a few shared ways of doing things. But that doesn't change the fact that they are kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? They're kind of working in different spheres, different fields. And so there are different considerations that need to be made. Is there any sort of standardization or a code of conduct, I suppose you would call it, in the sharing economy?
That is a great question. And I have to say, yes and yes, but not quite. So it was interesting when you mentioned that, it's a term that we all do now recognize. That said, I've been in this space for the better part of the last decade. So from very early stages where people didn't recognize this term to candidly today, I think the sharing economy as a phrase has gone beyond what the original founders, the original visionaries imagined. And what I mean by that is when we typically define the sharing economy, we're really looking at an economy that's based on what's called access over ownership. So business models based on accessing something rather than owning it all the time, and shared assets. Now, today, there is no rule on who can and can't call their company sharing economy. Who doesn't want to be part of the sharing economy? It sounds good, right? And what you have now are platforms and companies kind of falling over themselves to be part of the sharing economy. But, and I say this as a, it's not a criticism, it's an observation, but it is a blind spot that we now have a lot of things calling it themselves sharing economy, but there's nothing actually shared if you dig deeper. Now, these are parts of the digital economy, the platform economy, the on-demand economy, the gig economy, the freelance economy. That's great. And there are some overlaps with the sharing economy and these other terms, but the term sharing economy has really been expanded so broadly. And this is where the global piece gets really interesting. Two different countries could define the scope of their respective sharing economies quite differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to a kind of apples to oranges comparison. Mm. But at the end of the day, those original principles, which have to do with resource utilization, decentralization of assets based on networks, but also looking at how we're rethinking relationships and trust. I mean, these are all real drivers vis-a-vis traditional business that are being quite transformative, even if it is playing out somewhat differently in domestic markets.
And do you see the gig economy or the sharing economy as the way we are going to be working in the future?
So again, yes and. But this is, I do not believe that sharing will 100% overtake ownership. We will continue to own some things. I own things, you own things. But as a piece of the overall economic pie, the sharing economy is going to continue to grow because it's becoming increasingly clear that why would anyone own everything all the time if you didn't have to? And you can base this on cost, convenience, sustainability. Like, sharing makes a lot of sense for a lot of people, particularly for those assets that are high cost and or low frequency of use. Mm-hmm. If something is expensive and you don't use it very often, it just makes little sense. And when we start looking at our lives and you sort of can go through this daily life exercise, you start realizing the ways in which we have very asset-heavy lifestyles that in the digital world make less and less sense. So back to your question, the sharing economy will continue to play an increasingly important role in our overall economic pie, but the pie will also include ownership and, you know, other forms. Similarly, in the future of work, the gig economy will play an increasingly important, relevant role in the workplace. Will we still have jobs and traditional employment? Yes, but that will be a relatively smaller part than it has been for the last, you know, 50, 100, 300 years.
And considering the fact that we are seeing a lot of sharing companies emerge in a disruptive way, shall we say, that's like kind of the principle of it, do you think that our mindset shift has caught up quickly enough to what is actually happening on the ground? Because I think we've seen it time and time again of regulations kind of struggling to keep up with what has already happened with a company that has already entered the space. And similarly, I'm not sure whether the way we think about business or the way we think about regulations and companies and jobs and all that, whether that has actually caught up to what's occurring.
Yeah. So from a policy perspective, we definitely have not caught up. Mm. But I do like to remind people, and this is where, you know, I work with startups in this space. I work with policymakers. I'm really trying to bridge these two worlds and help them understand the respective importance of the other. Policy has always been a lagging indicator. And it's designed that way. Policy changes throughout history, and whether this is an issue of civil or human rights or an issue of business models, policy changes when it's become so clear that society has changed, mm-hmm. that it's time to change the rules on the books. The challenge we face today, though, is that the pace of change is so fast that this gap between policy and technology is widening. And that's real cause for concern because you wonder if there's a point after which you can ever catch up, so to speak.
We're talking today about the sharing economy. We're also going to be speaking about tourism and cities and the like. But right now, we're focusing on the sharing economy, especially in light of what's been going on in our country at the moment. Our guest is April Rinney, International Advisor and Founder of the Sharing Economy Working Group. If you have any questions, whether it's about your role in all of this, whether it's about just trying to keep up, you can send them through. Call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
It is 6:17 in the evening. You're with Lynn and Ayman, and live in the studio with us, April Rinney, international advisor and founder of the Sharing Economy Working Group at the World Economic Forum. And we're talking today about the challenges and joys, I suppose, of the sharing economy. If you have any questions or thoughts that you'd like to send through, call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. April, you know, there is, I think, and it's something that comes up when we discuss this a lot, this sense that there is this push and pull, right, between the freedom that the gig economy offers. And here I'm speaking about somebody who would be participating in it, right, not as a business owner. So there's the freedom on the one hand, but then there's also the lack of social protection on the other. How can companies and workers kind of negotiate that balance?
Oh, we are in the throes of this issue globally, where, again, we've built our policy regimes, globally, with the assumption that jobs and employment, being an employee, is the norm, it's the goal, it's the dream. And freelancing is something you would do if you couldn't get a job.
Mm.
But now we have a lot of people saying, I actually don't want the trappings, so to speak, the burdens of employment and, you know, employer control and full-time jobs and so forth, or full-time, working full-time. And they're saying there are so many more ways we can work now because of these new digital platforms. But the policy regime has not yet caught up. So on the one hand, there are all kinds of things that companies are seeking to do and often stuck and challenged to do because, for example, a company that wants to invest in its freelancers and provide them with professional development or something like that runs the risk of actually finding themselves in court where by the regulators they would say, well, no, you would only do that if they were employees.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you have the workers, half, and I shouldn't say half, it really varies where you are, but you have a significant number of workers in the gig economy saying, we want to be freelancers, we want the flexibility. And you have a significant number saying, and we want the protections of employment. And so right now we're in this weird system of trying to put round square pegs into round holes, if you take my point. But we're really stuck because what we're looking at, and this again is global, we've got either employees or independent contractors with nothing in between. It's binary. Mm-hmm. It's all or nothing. And what the future of work and the present of work is really about is hybrid workers, where we want the flexibility of freelancing, but we need some of the protections of employment for social safety nets as well as just the fabric of well-being.
Earlier, you mentioned a bit about how the concern is when there's a gap between policy and business and how it can get too far. So when does it become a concern when policy is not at all catching up with how gig-based businesses are working?
So I would argue that on balance, it's already, we're past the point of some concern. This is a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
This is not unique to Malaysia. This is happening everywhere. There are a handful of places, mostly in the Nordics, actually, that are fairly well, not prepared. But a lot of what we're talking about is, does government have the technical expertise to understand how these platforms work? Do you understand how you design these platforms? How is data captured and stored and shared and who has access to what? And understanding the guts of these platforms, that's a real big challenge. I mean, it's much different than going to an office or a factory and doing an inspection,
mm-hmm.
which is how we would have judged whether a company is doing a good job in the past. What you have now is, across the board, a lack of sufficient expertise within government of how these platforms work, which make it very hard to regulate something that you don't truly understand how it works. So one of the lowest hanging fruits and one of the most urgent things we need is deep technical expertise about platforms within governments worldwide.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that because you've advised Airbnb before, and we've also seen them having to adjust to new regulations in different countries. It's hit differently. But can you sort of take us through what happens when a company has to change tack after they've already grown to a certain size and influence because of precisely almost because of this policy catch-up game? Because I think we saw at a time, there was a point where Airbnb was really sort of entering lots and lots of different markets and neighborhoods, and then the regulations have, in essence, in some ways, caused a pullback in some areas. And I'm just curious about that, whether there is a need to shift direction, shift footing. I mean, what does it actually look like?
Yeah, so this is fascinating. And I can tell a story here where, Airbnb was founded in 2008. A couple of years later, I'd used the platform and I knew members of the team quite early. But one of my first trips using Airbnb, I went to Rwanda. Right? So not a big market for Airbnb at the time. And I went and there were 5 listings in the whole country. And I stayed at one of them. And I had a fabulous time. And I went back and I told the team, like, I went to Rwanda and I stayed with Airbnb. And they were like, we have places in Airbnb in Rwanda? They had no idea. But what I'm getting at here is, it is a platform that connects people. It doesn't actually even control where those markets, where those individuals might show up. Mm. Now, there are some restrictions against, say, North Korea and Iraq, for example, but they're pretty much everywhere. And the moment they were one of the first companies that was able to enter Cuba after the embargo was lifted by the U.S. some time ago, because they didn't need any physical presence. Mm-hmm. So back to how do you deal with this shifting regulatory space? I remember the day not that long ago where actually Airbnb has had a policy team for some time. They were knocking on doors trying to get meetings with governments. No one would pay attention to them. No one thought they mattered. They were tiny. They were fringe. They were, this is never going to make a dent.
No, hotels forever.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they tried and they couldn't get the door open, or if they wanted a meeting, they would show up with the person they wanted to meet with and a bunch of lawyers, which sets up a very different tone for the kind of opening conversation you'd like to have. So what do you do? You know, you keep knocking on the doors, you do what you can, but meanwhile you've got this platform where people are showing up and you don't necessarily control where they are and what they're doing. And then you have this collective awakening on the regulatory front, which is, whoa, this has grown a lot faster than we thought, but they kind of leapfrogged the whole regulatory negotiation process. And then much later, everyone has more at stake. And relationships can be, I don't want to say more contentious, it's just more the urgency of needing to figure this out becomes that much more clear.
So there's a food delivery service here that's recently come under fire because they introduced this new payment plan that could potentially halve the income of their riders. So have you seen a similar kind of situation like this happening with other countries? And how can a solution be found that can satisfy both business and the workers?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yes, so what's happening here with
Foodpanda, yeah.
If I can, yeah, I'll just say Foodpanda. It's not the first time I've seen something like this happen. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, what's interesting is this, so we can talk about it in terms of, okay, it's a business model and payment scheme shift. It's also very clearly an issue of worker classification. So one of the things, if you're an employee, you are guaranteed, one of the rights of an employee is to be guaranteed of a minimum wage. You are a freelancer, there is no such guarantee. Now, you can charge a lot, you can charge a little, but you have much more flexibility in terms of that. So here what we have, I like to remind people, it's not even as much about how payment is being calculated as it is what are the rights of the workers to say whether this is acceptable or not. If they were employees, something like this wouldn't even be possible. Mm-hmm. But they're freelancers. So, and as a freelancer in every country that I'm aware of, freelancers also don't have the right to collectively bargain or to unionize or to make their needs known as a collective. So what we've got here, I can say that in other countries where similar such shifts have happened, they have generally, and again, each case is different, but on balance, they've ended up shifting back. Because what they realize is there will be some workers who decide it's not worth it. They leave the platform. Now, it's easy for a company today to say, well, we have lots of supply and we'll just bring on more because attrition is high anyway. there does come a point at which that supply isn't infinite. You can't attract sufficient supply because they know what you're doing, and you end up getting the customers end up getting frustrated as well because they believe that the worker should be treated more equitably.
Well, while we're using the term worker, and we have just a couple of minutes before we have to head to the news, how would you draw the distinction between freelance workers and gig workers? Because we're trying very hard not to use the two interchangeably, but they do often get lumped up together.
Oh, and I applaud you. Thank you for that, because they're not quite the same. There is overlap. So the freelance economy is a broader term. And the term freelance simply means someone without one principal professional affiliation. Not an employee. This can include independent consultants, skilled professionals, Airbnb hosts, Grab drivers, very broad. Anyone who is not an employee. Now, within that, you might think of the gig economy as almost a subsection of that, because gigs are generally shorter-term tasks or projects done by independent workers. But gigs are, you know, drives, deliveries, generally lesser skilled. Just tasks, projects, little things. Whereas the freelance economy can include highly sophisticated. You have freelance lawyers, doctors, engineers, MBAs, C-suite roles who are freelance. Mm-hmm. The gig economy is usually for a smaller section of, I don't want to say less skilled, but very much transactional kind of just small tasks that need to be done.
We're speaking today with April Rinney, international advisor and founder of the Sharing Economy Working Group at the World Economic Forum, which I think might clue you in a bit to what we're talking about, which is precisely that. We're trying to kind of examine the sharing economy and where it's going, also how it's impacting us here in the country. If you have any thoughts, stories, questions, call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It is 6:36 in the evening. You're with Lynn and Ayman, and live in the studio with us, April Rinney, international advisor and founder of the Sharing Economy Working Group at the World Economic Forum. We're talking about the sharing economy, trying to really wrap our heads around the issues that are kind of inherent in it. And if you have any thoughts or questions, you can call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, just before the news, we were talking about Foodpanda and the sort of recent flurry of headlines that have surrounded it. And our youth minister has actually tweeted for consumers to sort of punish Foodpanda as a form of protest. Now, to be clear, it's not an official statement. It is not... It is whatever you call social media use from a government minister, I suppose, seeing that it's become a thing worldwide. What do you make of, I suppose, this sort of weighing in from members of government on private affairs or private businesses?
Well, one thing I can say is that around the world, we're finding government leaders participating in private sector affairs, but also private sector CEOs having to weigh in on issues of public that were typically the realm of public policy, whether that was worker rights, whether that was climate, whether that was human rights abuses, it's fascinating. There's a kind of blurring of that line in both ways. I do think we can look at this from a few different ways. I mean, I guess I look at it in terms of what is the kind of leadership that we need today? And I think leadership needs to look beyond borders. Those are both physical borders as well as, I think, mental borders. We need to have people who understand different disciplines and can speak different languages and understand what's at stake. I do think there is a line, a very delicate line to be drawn between meddling in another organization's affairs, outright meddling, and opining on the way that we want, you know, where do we want the arc of justice to fall? Where do we want the narrative of history to be written? Providing opinions, I find, particularly when we're trying, and I think in the case of the youth minister, we've got generational differences, we've got demographic differences, and to be able to bridge that in some way, not meddling, but sort of expanding, breathing more oxygen into the topic can be helpful.
So there's a lot of interest in sort of like strengthening or expanding the gig economy or the sharing economy. Does the growth of the sharing economy benefit governments and national economies?
Well, it certainly can, but here's the irony, or the rub, I suppose. once again showing how policies and structures are sort of outdated. Today, still a lot of countries base themselves and how they're doing on their GDP.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of become the holy grail. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is that the GDP, when it was designed, it was never designed to be a permanent metric. It was designed after World War II to, as a temporary measure, to transition wartime assets into non-wartime productive use. And when that was done, GDP was to be over. But by the time we had done that, the GDP had become this sort of holy grail that we couldn't get rid of. And here we are, many years later, stuck in this kind of outdated model. Now, when it comes to the sharing economy, what's fascinating is GDP measures new consumption, new production, purchasing, and owning things. So if all of us decide, if all of us needed to buy a car, to keep things simple, you know, previously GDP would say, okay, we're going to have three cars. If we decide that we're going to share a car, it's good for you, it's good for me, it's good for you, we save money, it's better for the environment, it's better for traffic, it's better all the way around. But GDP just went down by two-thirds because we're buying one car instead of three. So it really starts to make you go, oh my goodness, we need to revise that too. Some countries are starting to do that. So the UK, Japan, Korea, all of them are busy developing new metrics to include GDP, sorry, to include the sharing economy in GDP. And countries that have a robust sharing economy are likely understating their real economic growth and strength. And similarly, countries that are more stuck in an older ownership era are probably overstating their GDP, or at least in terms of their positioning to navigate the future.
And coming back to this issue of, I suppose, because I think I'm just still kind of mulling it over, this idea of what it means to work in the sharing economy, in the gig economy. California legislators approved a landmark bill recently. It was big news that requires companies like Uber and Lyft to treat contract workers as employees, which is very much that sort of divide that we've been talking about bridging. Do you see this becoming a trend globally? And what impact might it have on the gig economy?
Yeah, so this is a big deal. This is California AB 5, which is Assembly Bill 5. It's been passed. It has not been implemented. We don't know yet how that will go. But it does set a new kind of standard where, according to AB 5, workers will be presumed to be employees unless they can meet a strict test that shows they're clearly independent. So it's not just full stop, okay, automatically you're an employee and that's that. There are conditions and criteria that you have to meet to prove that, no, in fact, you're an independent. And we can go through those. But the big one, for example, for driving e-hailing platforms is that in order to be independent, what you do can't be core to what the platform does. And so in the case of an Uber or a Grab or a Lyft, you would say, well, you're a driver. Driving is central to what these companies do. Now, Uber and Lyft are arguing that they're not transportation companies, they're technology companies. But in the case of AB5, the judge is like, no, no, you're transportation. I'm sorry, that is core to what you do. So we'll see. I mean, this is very much, I don't want to say Wild West, but these are early days. I think we're going to see a lot. It's going to be very, very messy. We're going to see a lot of rules get passed and renegotiated and here and there. And, you know, even in the case of AB5 right now, it seems like New York State might be passing a similar law. I think other governments around the world will be looking at this. But I do think that we need more clarity on the independent worker employee distinction and having a hybrid model. I'm not convinced that AB5 is the best rule to get us there because it doesn't address this bigger issue of this not being black and white, but being gray.
That's right. And whenever we talk about this, I mean, earlier, for example, in the day when we were looking through sort of what we wanted to cover with you, I think one of the issues that came up is this idea of not ever having 100% situation, meaning, you know, if you want the flexibility that comes with being a gig worker, then you cannot then also say, oh, well, I don't have a social safety net. So I'm just thinking, is there a way forward where we could have both those things? Or are we stuck in this either or situation where, look, freedom, you want freedom, take it, but don't expect, you know, social security?
So I love this question. And I don't think that we're looking, and I'm not sure it's realistic to imagine that we can that we could have an infinite number of solutions with 100% security for each independent worker. Because even within the realm of freelancers and independent workers, there's incredible diversity.
Yeah.
Incredible. Mm. So I'm not looking for everyone to be 100% satisfied. What I do know is that we can do a lot better than we're doing today. And so you could imagine, and again, just hypothetically speaking, if a worker is working on a range of different platforms, okay, if they were an employee, they would have one job and that one employer would be responsible for 100% of their benefits. We don't have that now. But if you're spending, you know, to make it simple, 20% of your time on five different platforms, well, then each of those five platforms could contribute 20% of what your benefits would typically look like. Now, that is if we had the Provident Fund or the pool in place to make that happen. But that's not rocket science to imagine happening. Now, maybe you don't get to all five or 100% coverage, but maybe you get to 50% coverage. That's a lot better than what we've got today, which is zero or 100.
We're speaking today with April Rinney, international advisor and founder of the Sharing Economy Working Group at the World Economic Forum. If you have any thoughts about the gig economy, the sharing economy, just observations to offer, I think, on where we are right now, you can call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
It's 6:46 in the evening with Lynn and Ayman and April. April Rinney is here with us, international advisor and founder of the Sharing Economy Working Group at the World Economic Forum. We've been spending this past hour looking at the various issues within the sharing economy space. And we've also been talking about this shift in regulation. A lot of our time has been spent looking at policy because we must. Do you see these regulations or the potential move towards seeing what you dubbed earlier the grey, you know, amidst the black and white, do you see it changing the gig economy and the companies within it a lot, tremendously?
Over time, I think yes. I think, you know, we were talking earlier about the gap between technology and policy and who's picking up on what and policy being a lagging indicator. But actually, customers and users and participants tend to be the leading indicators. The world is changing. People are living, working, transacting in very new ways. Policies lagging behind. Policies trying to catch up. Meanwhile, individuals are sort of leapfrogging ahead sometimes. And so I bring all of this up because I do think ultimately it's almost inevitable that the sharing economy and the gig economy become a larger part of how we live our lives. And ultimately, policies do change, but it gets really messy between now and then. We don't have a steady state yet. And I think that things might actually get even more messy before they get clearer. And by the time they're clearer, some other things will probably change. You know, it's this iterative process, but we all need to get comfortable with the fact that this iteration can be fruitful, can get us somewhere better, but will it ever be perfect? I'm not sure.
And how will all this affect consumers?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating hornet's nest of issues as well, where, you know, on the one hand, at a very big picture level, we're looking at a world with far more choice in terms of how you meet your needs, how you work, how you raise your families, what your budget is. I mean, just massively more choices for taking care of ourselves and our families and building the economy and so forth. So that's one. Historically, from a regulatory perspective, we always assumed that if lower costs for users and consumers result, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And generally it is. But as we're seeing in the platform economy, just measuring things, benefits on the base of lower cost may not be a full picture of what we need to be looking at when it comes to things like data privacy, data ownership, protection. So I think that, again, is a very messy area where we're going to see more pushback. We're going to see more regulatory reform. I do not know how that lands, but even things like who owns your data. So I think from a customer, consumer perspective, big issues that we all need to be aware of there. Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's a whole other set of issues that arise when we start looking at what happens in the next 10 to 20 years where there will be more digital natives, more people born into a world of technology who have never known a world in which they can't find everything through their phone. When that becomes the norm, that becomes mainstream, and those individuals end up you know, starting their careers and getting in leadership positions. That's going to be a sea change because societally norms will have changed.
We have a question here from Hema who wants to say, it would be great if some realistic disadvantages of the sharing economy could be shared to give a better understanding of this trend.
Sure. So let's see. Disadvantages. So this is where a lot of the challenges, so we can talk about the upsides, we can talk about the blind spots. A lot of this is blind spots where when harnessed responsibly, the sharing economy has a lot of economic, environmental, social, practical benefits. When harnessed irresponsibly, and I would say there are lots of ways that can happen, one of the most common we see is companies that call themselves sharing economy, but actually at the end of the day, they just want to make a short-term profit. They're not necessarily building a sustainable business model for the long term. And ultimately, you have customers flee, you have company bankruptcies, you have, I mean, it's just chaos. And I think, you know, let's take the example of WeWork right now.
Okay, yes.
Right? WeWork IPO, that's not going to happen. Oh my goodness, this is a warning shot for all of us. Now, what's interesting, I want to be clear, WeWork is trying to establish an empire. WeWork tried to grow too fast in too many different directions, etc. There are all kinds of blind spots and downsides there. However, the concept of co-working, shared office space, remains wise, remains sustainable. And if you've been building a community co-working space over years with a loyal following and a focus on community, you're doing just fine. And that's the kind of sharing economy I think it's becoming clearer that we want to put front and center.
We have a question from Subra. What's your view on the regulations required imposed on the Grab drivers and their vehicles? Will this and similar policies stifle sharing economy in Malaysia and cause a negative impact for Malaysians, including exit of these companies from the Malaysia market, increases in prices, etc.?
That's a great question, and I can't profess to be that detailed of an expert on Malaysia, but I do understand with the PSV licenses and that sort of thing. So, and I say this with all due respect, where the PSV licensing requirement, yes, on the one hand, you do want drivers of any car that's transporting passengers to have some kind of license. But what we've done is taken a new model and tried to put it back in an old rule. I'm not sure what the PSV, what that particular license requirement accomplishes, other than to put those drivers on a level ground with taxi drivers, as opposed to saying, you know, what rules about taxis and taxi drivers might be outdated and might we need to actually reform the system as a whole. So I'm not sure. I mean, I think when companies decide to enter or exit a market, they bring into account many different factors. I'm not sure that a licensing requirement on its own is enough to make a company exit or make it certainly will affect drivers' ability if they can't pass it, you bet. I look at this and I go, we could have done something better. You know, this I get where what the intention is, but I'm not sure that this rule will actually achieve the desired outcome.
And a question from Azri who says, in your opinion, if one is to start a sharing economy business, what are the things that you have to look out for, especially to survive in the future?
Wonderful question. So this is probably a whole other session. But some of the big things, I think, as we look at who's succeeded and who has failed and what matters and so forth, you can't do enough homework before you actually launch, because keep in mind that sharing economy platforms are really about matching of supply and demand. And you don't want to have too much supply without enough demand. You don't want to have too much demand without enough supply. And getting those metrics right over time is actually harder than it looks. So having to really do your market research and make sure that you've built something that you can match real time supply and demand. I think there's always the question of funding and do you have enough funding at the right time and so on and so forth. And I want to be really clear, this is a separate issue, but there is a growing trend also when we look at the sharing economy, those platforms that are pressured to grow quickly are often the ones fueled by venture capital. We're looking at, you know, a situation in which we want to be looking more broadly at different kinds of capital and more patient capital and capital that's in for the sustainable long term. So back to building a business, if you're going to take funding, you want to make sure that it's the right match of funding and the same shared ethos in terms of what you're looking to build, and not everything is appropriate for venture capital.
So earlier you were mentioning about how there's this gap between government policies and how businesses run. So there's this question by Muhu, which I guess is related to that. Sharing economy is huge and has great potential to help Malaysians create income, not just for freelancers, but also for employees as second income. How can government play a more proactive role to support this?
Oh, this is great. And I'm not sure that there are, that we need different rules for if it's supplemental. I mean, yes, we need rules for freelancers, for sure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of the sharing economy is done in a kind of supplemental way, or we do fractional, you're participating in different platforms, each of which isn't deemed a full-time job, but together you kind of are creating a new vocation. There are lots, so many ways that, that government can support. I mean, it's both direct and indirect. One is, and I find this around the world, where in many countries there's actually still a stigma around freelancing, that you would do that only if you couldn't find a job. And I think being very public, and MDEC in particular does a great job of really showcasing how freelancers are the future, freelancers matter, freelancers are equally valid. But I think there's a lot more that government can do in that regard. Also, though, things like when you're a freelancer, you're responsible for filing your own taxes. Freelancers know this, but that's not necessarily easy. Provide those support systems, provide information portals for that to happen. Create a national network of co-working spaces. Create, you know, initiatives around remote work and connecting communities when people are working independently so that they may be working independently, but they still feel part of a larger community. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that you can really foster this shared sentiment, so to speak. And it's interesting to find there are places around the world that are starting to get more creative and innovative on exactly this kind of thing.
So a couple of questions in a couple of minutes, because we do have to wind up. Very quickly, we have this from OSK who says, could you name one startup unicorn that has good ethics?
BlaBlaCar. So BlaBlaCar, because
a bit of clarification. Thanks.
I mean, there are more than one, but or there is more than one. But BlaBlaCar is a French intercity ride-sharing platform. It operates in 28 countries all over Europe, Russia, parts of Latin America, you name it. Rather than ride-hailing within cities, BlaBlaCar, so you need to go from Kuala Lumpur to Penang, you have three extra seats in your car, you would like to fill that car and travel together. So BlaBlaCar is valued somewhere between $2 and $3 billion today. BlaBlaCar transports more than 4 times as many people as the entire European rail network every day at less than 1% of the cost of capital, because we're using assets we already have. Here's what I want to bring about, though, and I'll try to keep this brief, but the business model is such that if you have three extra seats in your car, you post your car on BlaBlaCar. You say, I'm leaving from this place at this time, 3 seats, join me. Each person pays a pro rata portion of the trip, such that if you are the driver and your car is full, you travel for free. You're not earning income, but everyone is saving money, and everyone is boosting green transport, and everyone is building community. And BlaBlaCar is 100% in compliance with current laws. BlaBlaCar itself earns a small transaction fee, so they're profitable already. But you think about the economic, environmental, and social benefits. These things are baked into the DNA of the company. It has all the right ethos, all the right dynamics, and you can't not like BlaBlaCar. And they're growing like weeds. They are a unicorn.
Also, I love the name. just on a...
And can I tell you how... So the name comes from when you post your car as a driver, you pick whether your car is a blah car, which is kind of like the quiet car on the train. I'm driving, but I expect everyone to read a book or listen to music. My car is a blah, blah car, which is conversational. Or my car is a blah, blah, blah car, which is kind of like the party car.
Oh,
I love it even more now. I didn't think that was possible. April, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We've been speaking today with April Rinney, international advisor and founder of the Sharing Economy Working Group at the World Economic Forum. You've been listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.